This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. Coming up, shocking levels of violence seen as Papua New Guinea's election draws towards a close.
Nights are becoming the worst. You hardly sleep. There's gunshots going around, there's shouting, there's killing, there's war cry.
As more Pacific countries look towards deep sea mining, scientists warn of noise pollution.
So this means that when these animals have to communicate in a noisy environment, they have to raise their voice or change the frequency of their voice in order to be heard above the background noise.
And Samoa's business community is welcoming the return of an Australian reality TV show.
The hotel they booked has got 170 rooms, so that's 170 less rooms, which means everyone else gets a bigger piece of the pie when tourists start coming back in as well. So it is good from that perspective. I think they're hiring some local staff.
But first, the level of violence during Papua New Guinea's long drawn-out election campaign continues to shock. The death count keeps rising, women are being raped, and estimated 3,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in PNG's highlands. As our correspondent Natalie Whiting reports, the United Nations is calling for more humanitarian assistance and says it's ready to respond to any call for help from the government in Port Moresby.
Women wail as the bodies of victims are carried through a crowd in Porgera in PNG's highlands. At least 18 people were massacred as a tribal fight in the area flares. But Provincial Police Commander George Karkas says there may be more victims.
We're still looking for more dead bodies.
The tribal fight has been raging for days, with homes looted and shops burned.
Nights are becoming the worst. You hardly sleep. There's gunshots going around, there's shouting, there's killing, there's war cry.
Rose Whalen from Porgera District Women's Association took her possessions and left her home for a night to sleep at her office.
The neighbouring village where our office is located, it was the only area that wasn't affected by the fighting, and everybody fled to that village. Now, during the night, they had rumors that those warring tribes were heading that way. All of them fled across, and we stayed up until the morning.
Police and army personnel were already stretched thin, dealing with election-related violence in other parts of Enga province. The two sides in the tribal fight took advantage of that. The government has said hundreds of extra security personnel are being sent to the region. Acting Superintendent Karkas says the main town in Porgera has been deserted.
The town is empty. All the public servants have fled. We're just waiting for more reinforcements.
It isn't the only area where people have been displaced. The United Nations estimates 3,000 people have been forced to flee violence in the highlands during the election period. Schools, bridges and health facilities have been damaged or destroyed, and police say there are unconfirmed reports of widespread killings. Rose Whalen says the two warring clans there trying to stop neighbouring villages from helping those who are fleeing.
Threatening those village leaders, saying that you are not allowed to accommodate them or feed them.
She believes the massacre yesterday was retribution against a community that assisted the refugees. Ms. Whalen says several women have been raped during the violence.
They're being raped by both the warlords and opportunities.
People are trying to help those who are fleeing.
We are working with the churches to accommodate them within the church area.
The UN has called for the state to uphold the rule of law, swiftly investigate and prosecute perpetrators, and provide humanitarian assistance. It says it's ready to respond to any potential call for assistance from the PNG government. There are concerns we could see more violence before the election is over, with just over a week left to complete the election and with counting in several places running behind schedule. The Prime Minister has issued an appeal for people to refrain from resorting to violent or unlawful activities that could disrupt the process.
That was PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting. As we heard, Papua New Guinea's election voting period has been steeped in violence and controversy. The polling period is set to close in less than a week, but when all the votes are tallied, will people be able to trust the process? And what does this election period reveal about the integrity of PNG's democracy? Peter Aitsi is the chair of PNG Transparency International.
In most areas, the community themselves have been probably the key players in making sure that the elections have been conducted in a peaceful manner and that people have been able to exercise their vote. But unfortunately, as we expected in some of the more problem areas, the performance of our electoral commissioner and electoral commission and also the government in terms of their initial preparation has left a lot to be desired.
How would you compare to PNG's past elections?
Transparency International has had close to 400 election observers out in the field. And the data that we're receiving back suggests that this election is probably going to be our worst. And definitely 2017 was bad, but this particular election will be worse, we fear.
Why do you expect it to be worse than the previous one?
We're seeing, unfortunately, a number of killings as a result of the elections and the fights between various candidates. At the beginning of the elections, we obviously were hampered by the electoral roll not being updated. So many of our voters, many of our citizens were disenfranchised and were not able to exercise their vote.
When people don't see their names on the electoral roll, is that's led to frustration? Has this been one of the main reasons why there's been violence in parts of the country?
It's added to a dysfunctional handling of the elections, and this causes conflict amongst communities. Candidates don't trust the process. Voters don't see themselves fairly represented in the process, and as a result, it creates tension.
Now, the Electoral Commission has struggled a bit with this. What do you think is the source of the problem there?
Look, I believe, from the 2017 elections, there was a widespread concern of the conduct of those elections. TIPNG, with a number of observer groups, put in a report saying that we needed to take immediate action after the elections to reform our system. And that was to initiate the update of the electoral rolls and then to look at the way that we managed our elections so that we would be able to deal with some of the specific challenges that PNG face, such as remote communities and rugged terrain and the logistical challenges that our elections face every 5 years. But unfortunately, that was not given the focus from the government. And as a result, we stumbled into these elections less than well prepared. And a key example of that was the appointment of our electoral commissioner, really only months away from the issue of writs.
Now, when all the votes are tallied and we get the result, do you think Papua New Guineans will be able to trust the election results?
This is our fear at TIPNG. Because of these concerns, what we've experienced in these elections, it undermines the integrity of the elections itself. And that's not good because it raises concerns about the legitimacy of those elected and unfortunately it undermines the credibility of whatever government is formed. So that's really the concern for us. We now need to, as a community, as a society, to focus on closing out or completing the elections and doing so as much as we can in an orderly and a legal manner so that at least as a society or as a community, we can then have some form of government that has the mandate and the authority from its citizens.
That was PNG Transparency International Chairman Peter Aitsi. Now, looking across the Pacific, a study produced by a multinational research team has found that noise pollution from any future deep-sea mining venture could reverberate through the ocean over hundreds of kilometres. As Adam Jacobson reports, the findings will add further weight to the arguments put forward by those Pacific Island nations that want the whole idea of undersea mining to be put on hold indefinitely.
The analysis by Australian, Japanese and Hawaiian scientists has discovered the sound from just one mine could travel up to 500 kilometres. Christine Erb, one of the study's authors and an underwater acoustics expert at Perth's Curtin University, says the practice could have consequences for marine life.
So, for example, there are studies that have shown that whales on migration swim a detour around noisy offshore industrial installations. There are also several studies that have demonstrated a Lombard effect in whales. So this means that when these animals have to communicate in a noisy environment, they have to raise their voice or change the frequency of their voice in order to be heard above the background noise.
Exploration licenses have been issued for potential mining in the Clarion-Clipperton zone. an area spanning 4.5 million square kilometres between Mexico and Hawaii. The area is abundant in mineral-rich lumps known as polymetallic nodules, which contain essential metals like cobalt and zinc needed to make batteries. Ms. Erb says more investigation is needed before mining could be done safely, because so little is known about the deep sea.
We need to really understand the ecosystem down there so that we can manage any resource development in a sustainable way, which I'm sure can be done. I mean, we all need energy, we all need minerals, but it needs to be developed in an environmentally sustainable fashion.
At the United Nations Oceans Conference in June, Palau, Fiji and Samoa announced their opposition to deep sea mining and called for a moratorium on the emerging industry. But four Pacific nations, Nauru, Tonga, Kiribati and the Cook Islands, are already issuing exploration licenses for their own mining projects. Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown, in a speech in March, said the polymetallic nodules were golden apples waiting to be harvested.
This new industry will provide us the opportunity to diversify our economy, a more sustainable economy that can provide a buffer to the impacts of future economic shocks and offers more opportunities for our people's prosperity.
He added the Cook Islands was playing its part in curbing climate change by providing materials needed for carbon zero technology. Alex Herman is the commissioner for the nation's Seabed Mining Authority. She says there have been a number of misconceptions around the Cook Islands investigations, and the nation hadn't approved any mining yet.
There is this view that countries are on the verge or there's a rush to go into mining. That's certainly not the case. Particularly with the Cook Islands, we've been very clear that right now we're only allowing exploration. We just want to do research so that we can better inform ourselves about whether we can proceed to that next stage.
Ms. Herman says the moratorium is not in the Cook Islands' best interests because it's ambiguous and arbitrary.
Importantly, they impinge on the sovereign rights of countries, including the Cook Islands. It's unclear with these moratorium calls what areas will be covered, the activities they will affect, because there's no consistency in the moratorium proposals. For example, they seek to impose arbitrary timeframes on the sector's development instead of focusing on the science. And that's what the Cook Islands, along with a lot of other countries, are looking at.
But Alfred Ralifo, the Senior Policy and Government Affairs Manager for the Worldwide Fund for Nature Pacific, says the opposite. He's concerned not having a Pacific-wide consensus on the practice will lead to growing issues.
That is why a moratorium is needed to slow down the process and to allow for more scientific research, investment in scientific research on the deep sea here in the Pacific, and also more research needed to look at the ecological, social and economic impacts of deep sea mining.
Mr. Ralifo says other options for finding resources need to be investigated before deep sea mining is committed to.
Before we go towards deep sea mining, let's look at how investing in technology that we can use to help recycle the metals that are already there instead of looking for more raw metal material.
Australia's National Science Agency has also agreed to work with controversial deep sea mining projects across the Pacific. The UN-linked International Seabed Authority is expected to release regulations for deep sea mining in June next year.
Adam Jacobson with that report. The reality TV show Survivor Australia is returning to Samoa. Local tourism operators have confirmed rumours that the show will commence filming in the coming weeks. Despite no official announcement, a pier is abuzz with anticipation. Kyle Evans with more.
Tourism operators have confirmed rumours that the popular TV game show Survivor Australia is heading back to Samoa for the first time since 2017. The deputy chairman of the country's tourism board, Nathan Bucknell, is also the general manager of the Tormesina Island Resort, and he says production is not far off.
It's good for the local economy here. I mean, it's you've got all those people coming in. They've booked up one whole hotel. One and a half, really, because another one that they're using as well. So kind of one and a half hotels they've booked up. It's good for that hotel. It's good for the other hotels because, you know, it's taking occupancy out. So it's meaning that the hotel they've booked has got 170 rooms. So that's 170 less rooms, which means everyone else gets a bigger piece of the pie when tourists start coming back in as well. So it is good from that perspective. I think they're hiring some local staff, 40 local staff to assist, which is great for 6 months. And yeah, of course, it's always good to any kind of advertising of the destination, whether it be on reality TV or whatever, is always great. So the roll-on effects will be good for tourism industry.
The news coincides with the country's plans to reopen to international tourism next month. It also follows an application from Qantas to launch direct flights to Samoa from Australia.
Qantas are going to be flying in soon, so it's good timing, I guess, from that perspective, because you know, Qantas has never flown in before. It's always been Virgin. Virgin aren't coming until March 23, and Qantas will look at ramping up flights as soon as their license is approved, etc., and that'll be great. Qantas are coming at the moment, but they're on closed flights because at the moment it's only Samoans coming back, repatriation, etc. But once borders open, I think that'll change quickly and there'll be flights out of Brisbane and Sydney.
Former Survivor contestant Jericho Malabonga, who also happens to be a Qantas flight attendant, knows Samoa well. He won the reality show when it was shot there in 2017, and he says it's an untapped tourist destination.
I think Samoa kind of provides kind of like a getaway from Australia, especially after 300, I don't know, like Melbourne specifically. I live in Melbourne and we've been locked down for like almost a year or something like that. So for us to get away from Australia, like Samoa is the best place to go to right now, I reckon.
Jericho says close to 400 crew work on each Survivor series, which takes several months to shoot.
I mean, we're talking about like the people just driving the cars for transport, and then you've got your chefs who obviously cook for the crew and stuff, because obviously they need to be fed and stuff like that. But you don't see that until you're out of the game. And then you're like, man, you actually see how big the production is. But at the when you're playing, you only see the cameramans, which you think, oh, it's such a small team. There's only about like a good like 4 or 5 cameras in your tribe. And then it gets bigger when you're actually on the challenges, because then there's like, you know, the crane cameras and all of that stuff. You got your producers watching in and a few of the challenge team. But apart from that, you don't really see the back end until you're actually out of the game or you're voted out.
From a gameplay perspective, he says the Samoan climate offers the ultimate battleground.
The most amazing thing about Samoa was that, yeah, it was the fact that there was just torrential rain, and that's when you know that you're actually playing Survivor. I mean, obviously, I played back around April, till around like I think I came in end of April, started in May, and then finished around June. We just caught the end bit of a tropical cyclone, and because of that, the first 2 weeks was just dreadful. But it was like, that's how you want to start the game, right? Like, to just be in shock. If you really want to play the raw, like organic Survivor, that's the place, because like the torrential rain, the bugs, everything that makes a massive, like, good TV show in Survivor. So,
that's the Survivor theme, and the show is making a return to Samoa. And that was former Survivor contestant Jericho Malabonga ending that report by Kyle Evans. Now for some sports news. At the Pacific Islands Forum in Fiji, much of the talk was about Australia mending fences and strengthening relations with island nations in the face of China's growing influence. One area where Australia is making great strides is in the sporting arena, with the Pacific Oz Sports spending substantial sums of money in the region to fund the Kaiviti Silktails and the PNG Hunters. Now, though, Papua New Guinea has bigger ambitions with a bid to field a team in the NRL backed by government. Prior to the 2019 Australian election, an amendment at the annual conference committed the Labour Party to investigate how to get PNG into the competition. So now that the Labour government is in power, will they deliver on the pledge and realise a dream for a nation where rugby league is the national sport? Hunter Fujek lectures in sports management at Deakin University in Melbourne and spoke to the ABC's Richard Ewart.
It wasn't explicit in the most recent election policy, so I don't think we can take it as a given. I guess more broadly, there does seem to still be some appeal behind the proposal.
It's one area, isn't it, really, where Australia surely has an advantage. They can deliver an NRL team for Papua New Guinea, whereas clearly China could never do that.
Absolutely, there's an opportunity here. You know, 50% of the NRL athlete base has ties to the Pacific, whether that's Micronesia, Melanesia, or the broader Pacific. So I guess the question is whether the incremental benefit from moving a PNG team up to the NRL will outweigh the costs that come with that opportunity.
But clearly there's a lot of Australian government money going into Pacific sport at the moment. The Fijian team, the Silktails, in essence, they wouldn't exist without support from Australian money. So isn't it perhaps a simpler case as putting a bit more into the PNG setup and they could get the bid that the country craves?
I guess there's a sense of scale here. You know, the costs of putting together a semi-professional team at the second tier level might cost a couple million per annum versus an NRL team which operates probably at about a $30 million minimum cost base. So it's quite a jump up. But at the same time, you know, Australia's total aid spend in 21-22 was $4.3 billion across various components. And we've got a very concerted effort to increase that in the Pacific region. So it is definitely a bit of a cost increase relative to what we're doing at the moment, but still a relatively small investment for what could be a very big opportunity for soft power.
What do you think it would take to progress this matter now? The PNG government have clearly stated that they're backing a bid for the country to join the NRL. At the moment, we're looking at possibly 2026 before they get the nod, and then maybe 2028 when they actually start playing. But presumably, if the Australian government got involved and put in dollars and cents, that whole process could be speeded up, couldn't it?
I guess the next step is really for the Australian government to begin offering some sort of firm commitments. Of course, from the NRL's perspective, there is an opportunity cost because it is difficult to envisage there being more than 18 teams over the next period of time. There's competing bids in Perth and a second team in New Zealand, which offer benefits around player development and commercialization. So giving that spot to Papua New Guinea comes with trade-offs for competing positions. So I think realistically what would have to happen, much like what's happening with AFL in Tasmania, where the Tasmanian government is sort of being held to ransom a little bit in terms of making firm financial commitments for decades into the future, the Australian government will have to make a firm commitment potentially of $10 to $15 million per annum just to really bring this bid to be viable as a competition in terms of competing in the NRL, let alone what that might mean beyond in terms of support around regulatory frameworks, around supporting this club competing in the NRL. So I think there'll have to be some firm commitments and not just for 5 years, 10 years, but potentially 15, 20 years.
Could you see a situation where Anthony Albanese makes the trip to Papua New Guinea in a couple of months' time, shall we say, when they've sorted out the result of the election over there? We know who the Prime Minister is. It wouldn't be a bad offering, would it, for a first meeting on PNG soil?
We've already seen Anthony Albanese be very proactive in terms of rebuilding international relations with certain countries where that's been required. And undoubtedly, a trip to Papua New Guinea based around rugby league, and he is a very mad rugby league supporter around the South Sydney Rabbitohs, could offer a really great opportunity to build on those relations.
This has been talked about in the past, of course, the idea of having a PNG side in the NRL. There was a lot of support during the last World Cup when PNG Kumuls played games in Port Moresby. A lot of ex-players support this idea. Have we perhaps now reached the point where this genuinely could happen and maybe sooner than some people might think?
I think there's absolutely potential for the proposal, but there's a lot of hurdles to overcome, both in terms of, I guess, the government level support, both in Papua New Guinea and Australia. But then there's actually broader sort of commercial and logistical hurdles. You know, it's quite unlikely that a PNG-based team is going to be able to recruit the best existing players in the NRL, obviously depending on whether they're based in Port Moresby or in North Queensland. But either way, it seems quite unlikely that they're going to be able to recruit. We're already seeing the 17th team struggle to recruit, and they're based in Brisbane. So I think there needs to be broader strategic planning around developing the pathways so that if there is an NRL level team, they will be able to be competitive with PNG players in that team. So, you know, at the moment, the PNG Hunters are competitive but not dominant at the second tier. So then to promote a team into the NRL is going to create challenges around player development and recruitment. And ultimately, you know, if there's going to be a new team, they have to be competitive, which as of yet, that hasn't necessarily been mapped out as to how that would occur. So there's the government angle of support, but then there's also more logistical elements to figure out. So it's definitely a possibility, but perhaps not quite on the immediate horizon.
Hunter Fujek, who lectures in sports management at Deakin University, speaking there to the ABC's Richard Ewart. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.